Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. The election is in just 14 days. The winner of the presidential election will be decided by a handful of states, including Arizona. President Biden won Arizona in 2020 by only 10,457 votes. That is less than a 1% margin. Native Americans make up 5% of the population. There are nearly 6.8 million American Indian and Alaska Natives living in the United States. Of those, almost 5 million are eligible to vote. So today we're discussing what is at stake for Native American voters in the election. Donald Trump rolled back policies that protect the rights of indigenous peoples, including shrinking the Bears Ears Monument by 85% to open up the area for drilling, pushing forward the Keystone XL pipeline, and opening up parts of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for drilling. Project 2025 would give the green light to even more mining, drilling, and deregulation on indigenous lands. Now, this doesn't get much attention, but it is important to note that Native Americans were not given the right to vote in this country until 1924, when the Indian Citizenship Act was passed. Joining us is Jacqueline DeLeon, a senior staff attorney at the Native American Rights Fund, a nonprofit that provides legal assistance to Native tribes, organizations, and individuals. Hi, Jacqueline. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. The election is in just 2 weeks. How engaged are Native American voters across the country compared to, say, 2020 or even 2016? What are you hearing on the ground?
Well, Native Americans are remarkably resilient. And I will say that over the last 10 years or so, we've seen a real notable uptick in the Get Out the Vote organizations on the ground. The tribes themselves are becoming incredibly engaged. And Native Americans are becoming increasingly aware of the tremendous political power that they have. And so I will say that engagement is increasing, although the barriers that Native Americans continue to face are still daunting.
And we'll talk about those barriers in a minute. You co-authored a report called Obstacles at Every Turn, Barriers to Political Participation Faced by Native American Voters. Jacqueline, we've been doing so many shows about what is at stake in this election. What are you hearing from voters? What concerns them the most about what is going to happen in just 2 weeks?
Well, some of our sister organizations have done some polling on what it is that Native Americans care about the most. And top among their lists are environmental concerns, the missing and murdered Indigenous women crisis across Indian country, the economy, and of course, tribal sovereignty.
And when it comes to the environment, I mentioned a few things that happened under the Trump administration, just rolling back so many policies that protect the rights of Indigenous peoples, opening up more areas for drilling, and then Project 2025 would give the green light to even more mining, drilling, and deregulation on Indigenous lands. What are you hearing from Native Americans about that?
Well, Native Americans are certainly concerned about that. They're also concerned about a myriad of issues. Native Americans are not single issue voters. They care most about the politicians that will go out to them, be responsive to their communities, and will actually make the effort to engage them on the ground. Too many politicians on both sides of the aisle do not really invest in making the trips out to reservations and out to Native communities to make their pitch. So we are hoping for an increased participation from candidates that understand that Native Americans votes deserve to be earned.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because obviously Native Americans, like everyone, they're not a monolith. But we are hearing a lot about the Black male vote. That's getting a lot of attention this time around. And then the Latino vote, especially around support for Trump. And so what are you seeing in Indian country? Over the weekend, I saw a number of pieces about Arizona Senate candidate Ruben Gallegos' eight-mile hike to the Havasupai Village in the Grand Canyon. The only way to get down there is to either hike or take a helicopter. And he walked to talk to people in the Havasupai Canyon. So what are you hearing from natives about whether or not they are being visited by politicians?
I think there's certainly been an uptick in engagement. Again, you know, when Native Americans, I think you mentioned the Arizona race, right? Native Americans flex their political power and credited really for Joe Biden's win in Arizona because so many areas had pulled through and decided to cast their vote that way. And as a result, I think Native Americans saw responsiveness, for example, the selection of Secretary of Interior Deborah Holland in response to that flex of Native political power. And I think that Native Americans are continuing to demand that type of attention and responsiveness, which is exactly what the American system was designed in theory to do, right? Have Native Americans flex their political power and then have a response.
And I know that there are so many different responses to this question, but I wonder, when you talk to people about what they have seen under the Biden administration with Deb Haaland in such a powerful position, what really strikes you? Because I know that a lot of Native Americans are really angry about the Biden administration's drilling policies and what we've seen there, but what strikes you when you're talking to people?
Well, you know, I think at the end of the day, Native Americans have, an array of choices in front of them. What we can do is just let folks know what the responsiveness is from each candidate and lay out their platforms and let them make their choices.
Well, if you'd like to join us, if you are Native American, if you'd like to talk about what's important to you, what are your thoughts about what's at stake in this election? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Jacqueline De Leon, a senior staff attorney at the Native American Rights Fund. This is a nonprofit that provides legal assistance to Native tribes, organizations, and individuals. And Jacqueline co-authored a report called Obstacles at Every Turn, Barriers to Political Participation Faced by Native American Voters. Jacqueline, I am guessing that a lot of people do not know that Native Americans were not given the right to vote until 1924 in this country.
That's right. So, Native Americans were, in theory, given citizenship, not necessarily the right to vote. The right to vote was actually restricted by states for years after. In 1924, Native Americans were unilaterally conferred citizenship, but really it wasn't until the 1940s and 1950s that states like Arizona and Utah and New Mexico finally allowed, in theory, Native Americans the right to vote. Before that, they had explicitly said through a variety of frankly racist justifications, for example, that Native Americans were not competent to vote, that they were not allowed to vote in those states. And then following really the civil rights movement of 1965 was when Native Americans were fully, in theory, again, enfranchised. But then we saw in places like Arizona the imposition of literacy tests, which were designed explicitly to keep Native voters off of the voting rolls. So really, it has been a continual struggle for the right to vote.
Can you tell us more about those literacy tests? When did that happen?
Yeah, in the through the 1970s until the Voting Rights Act had responses to those literacy tests, but those were imposed directly after the Voting Rights Act came into to play, and it was designed in places like Arizona and Alaska to keep Native Americans from being able to be fully enfranchised, because of course Native Americans were unable to meet those literacy requirements.
Now, I remember when your report came out, In 2017 and 2018, 9 public hearings were held to better understand how Native Americans are systemically and culturally kept from fully exercising their franchise. More than 120 witnesses testified from dozens of tribes across the country. And so then the final report came out, Obstacles at Every Turn, and there were 2 updates released in 2021. What really concerns you a couple of years later, now in 2024, about obstacles to allowing Native Americans to vote?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the landscape continues to be extremely dire. So not only are the logistical barriers that we discussed in the report still true, so those are, you know, things like extremely long distances to registration, early voting and polling places, poor roads that can be, you know, really difficult to pass in November, issues with the lack of addressing on Native American homes that make it difficult to register and have it more likely to have registrations rejected, the lack of residential mail in many Native American communities, which means that Native Americans don't have the ease of voting and can't overcome those logistical barriers through vote by mail. All of those logistical issues remain true. But also we see this rising anti-democratic movement across the United States where states are imposing laws that are designed to cut off, you know, vulnerable voters. So, you know, in Arizona, for example, this year we had to beat back a law that required proof of residential location when they knew that 40,000 Native American homes don't have addresses on them. Mm-hmm. And so really, you know, it's a dire landscape when it comes to voting rights. And Native Americans in particular are subjected to some of the worst abuses.
So for those who do not have a physical address, are they now allowed to vote, or can you give us an update on that lawsuit?
Yeah, so we were able to win at summary judgment and able to get secure a variety of means by which Native Americans could prove up that proof of residential address, including showing a tribal ID, even if it didn't have an explicit address on it. But, you know, I think that the intent of that law remains really telling.
What other lawsuits would you like to talk about? Because I was just thinking about how we closely follow Democracy Docket. Mark Elias runs this organization, and, you know, across the country, there are so many Republican efforts to suppress the vote. And so what is happening in Indian country right now?
Well, across Indian country, we have been winning lawsuits, frankly. Native Americans have an over 90% success rate in front of a variety of conservatively appointed and, judges, as well as, you know, liberally appointed judges. And the reason is because, sadly, our facts are usually so bad that we hardly ever lose. In a place like North Dakota, we were able to beat back a law that, again, required addresses on IDs in order to vote when the legislature was very well aware that there were many Native American homes in North Dakota that did not have addresses on them, which to me is a literacy test, right? Requiring a requirement that, you know, Native Americans can't meet through no fault of their own, but rather through the structural failures of their communities, is a modern day literacy test. And then, you know, in North Dakota, we've continued to win across the board in our redistricting lawsuits. We've won 3 redistricting lawsuits in North Dakota just this year. But tomorrow, we have an oral argument in a case that where the Eighth Circuit has found that under the Voting Rights Act, individuals and tribes don't have the right to bring Voting Rights Acts cases at all under the Voting Rights Act through a clause saying that there's no private right of action and that only the DOJ can bring those cases. And so we brought a Voting Rights Act also under a different statute trying to have a cause of action. And tomorrow we'll determine whether or not in the Eighth Circuit, individual plaintiffs can bring Voting Rights Act claims at all. It's an incredibly radical case. You know, I think Native Americans are at the heart of this battle for recognition and for rights.
Mm. Transportation is also so important. In some parts of Indian country, voting precincts are an hour or more away. Can you also talk about that and how that's being dealt with?
Absolutely. It's extremely frustrating. You know, we've talked to county officials, and we've said, hey, you know, you really need to get voting services out to the reservation. You know, you need to get early voting and registration and equitable polling place access. And they say to us, well, it's just too hard to get out there. And you know who it's also really hard to get out there for? You know, the Native American voter that has to travel these extreme different distances and who also often, too often, lived in extreme poverty. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Native Americans would have to expend the resources. One, they'd have to have a roadworthy vehicle. The roads can be unpaved. And so in November, the weather can be poor. And so they'd have to, you know, traverse an incredible amount of distance in a roadworthy vehicle, which would be expensive and many Native Americans don't have. And then on top of that, they'd have to pay the gas to get there and then account for, you know, that amount of time that it would take to get there and back. And so really, these are incredibly unreasonable barriers. And I think that transportation issue alone highlights how unfair it is. And then I think also highlights an important point, which is, you know, Native Americans are often cast as apathetic or, you know, uncaring or not wanting to engage. But really, it's the logistical barriers that are communicating to them over and over again that the system is not for them.
Right. Jacqueline De Leon is senior staff attorney at the Native American Rights Fund, a nonprofit that provides legal assistance to Native tribes, organizations, and individuals. In states like Arizona, Native Americans really are and can determine the outcome of elections. So obviously, for many, many reasons, the Native vote is really important, but especially in a state like Arizona, it is so crucial. I mean, when you look at, we talk a lot about Georgia, that's also really important, but in Arizona, Biden won by only 10,457 votes. So if you have any questions or comments for Jacqueline, she's going to be with us for about 8 more minutes. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Jacqueline, at the Native American Rights Fund, you all put up a video, I believe it was in the late July, about just what people in Indian country are dealing with around the vote. And you start with Gabriela Cesares Kelly, a Pima County recorder. And she just talked about, she said it's the first time she's been able to talk about how hard COVID was. And it just made me think about what Indian country had to deal with COVID. It's just kind of easy to forget how horrible that was. And that was also right around election time.
Yeah, that's right. It was an extremely difficult time across Indian country. And, you know, I think it really showed the resiliency and the heart of Native communities, how we rallied and tried to protect our elders and communities. And, you know, Native Americans have a lot at stake when it comes to political engagement. And I think COVID demonstrated that, which is, you know, you have to compare how the federal government responded to a crisis and, you know, whether or not you're content with that. Native people have to, you know, exercise their political power in order to, you know, receive the services that they deserve. Mm.
What at this point, what still needs to be improved? And who is working on these issues beyond election day? So of course, politicians tend to go to places they never go to because there's an election. But let's say in, you know, the middle of 2025, are politicians still working on these issues?
Yeah, so, you know, Native Americans deserve to have their votes campaigned for, and they deserve to have their votes rewarded. That's how American democracy works. And unfortunately, too often we have our communities being ignored. But Native Americans hold tremendous amount of political power. We've mentioned Arizona several times, but the number of eligible Native Americans in states like Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, and North Carolina are larger than the margins by which those states were decided in the last presidential election. And those are Native American votes that are being left on the table because of these issues. And so, you know, really what Native Americans deserve is the Native American Voting Rights Act, NAVRA, which at the federal level would mandate on-reservation registration, early voting and polling sites in an equitable manner. And so, you know, no more of these excuses of it's too hard to get out there to give equitable polling and services. Instead, it would be federally mandated. And that's really what we're pushing for.
Right. We had an email about the important Senate race in Montana between John Tester, Democrat, Tim Sheehy, a Republican. We just played some sound last week of Tim Sheehy making horrific racist comments about Native Americans in Montana. Can you tell us about any of the work you're doing up in Montana?
Yes, in Montana, we've been fighting voter suppression for over 5 years. So there, you know, again, Native Americans flex their political power, and then we see an immediate backlash. So following Native Americans being attributed to the win of Senator Tester and contributing to his candidacy, the legislature passed a ban on ballot collection. In Montana, there are there's in so many places no residential mail delivery, and the distances to polling places and ballot drop sites can be 40 or 50 miles away. Mm-hmm. And so it's extremely common for organizations to go and pick up and drop off ballots for impoverished Native Americans. And we have a case that we won that says that, you know, banning ballot collection goes against Montana's constitutional right to vote because of the extreme barriers that Native Americans face and their reliance on ballot collection. The legislature, following that case, passed another ballot collection ban and then also a ban on same-day voter registration, which, of course, Native Americans who have to travel these extreme distances disproportionately rely on being able to register the same day that they can vote. We again beat back that law as, again, an unconstitutional infringement on Montanans, Native Montanans' right to vote. And so those were huge battles that have been taking place over years and were designed to suppress the Native American vote. And just this last couple of months, the state has appealed to the United States Supreme Court in an attempt to have the Supreme Court weigh in on their state constitutional claim. And so really, they are relentless in this desire to keep Native Americans from being able to fully access the franchise. Mm-hmm.
Jacqueline, how long have you been doing this work?
About 6 years at the Native American Rights Fund, but I've been a litigator for a little longer than that.
I ask because I just wonder, are you seeing these voter suppression efforts, are they just getting worse every year? I mean, you really have to pay close attention to what is happening, and I just wonder how you all are able to really keep tabs on this so you can... You have to file the lawsuits as quickly as possible, right? Can you just explain how that works?
Yeah, it's a process. We also run the Native American Voting Rights Coalition, which is a collaboration of organizations like NARF, the National Congress of American Indians, and it's also composed of regional organizations. So on the ground, GOTV organizations that are incredible across the country, tribal organizations. I really encourage everybody to look up local tribal organizations to contribute to. But these organizations will often tip us off to what's going on at a local level. And we'll also, we also monitor the laws pretty closely and are part of national organizations that are in conversation about this voter suppression. But you're absolutely right. The voter suppression is absolutely relentless. And it's designed really to cut off a few thousand voters there, a few thousands voters there. And really, when we look at the margins, those few thousand voters make all the difference.
Yes, exactly. That it just shows that a few thousand voters do really matter, or else they wouldn't be passing these laws.
That's right. So we are really, we really believe that voter suppression occurs because the Native vote is powerful. And we are really trying to encourage folks to Native people to recognize and own that power. And they can access more resources at vote.narf.org.
Jacqueline De Leon is a senior staff attorney at the Native American Rights Fund, a nonprofit that provides legal assistance to Native tribes, organizations, and individuals. Jacqueline, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Today, we are talking about what is at stake for Native American voters across the country. Just a reminder, so much happened under Donald Trump. He rolled back policies that protect the rights of indigenous peoples, including shrinking the Bears Ears Monument by 85% to open up the area for drilling. He pushed forward the Keystone XL pipeline and opened up parts of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for drilling. Project 2025 would give the green light to even more mining, drilling, and deregulation on indigenous lands. We've been talking with Jacqueline about voter suppression in Indian country, and she and her staff at the Native American Rights Fund have been filing and winning lawsuits to make sure that Native Americans have the right to vote, which they did not get in this country until 1924. We'll continue talking about the Native vote. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with Lindsay Owens, Executive Director of the Groundwork Collective. She says most economists have gotten inflation wrong. She says we have to look at corporate profit margins. They have been at 70-year highs, and they have been enabled by price gouging. She says some solutions include Kamala Harris's price gouging plan and taking on monopolies. We hope you can join us tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you're in the Bay Area, we hope you can join us on election night. We will be hosting a live broadcast at 111 Minna in San Francisco. It's a free event. You can find more information at kalw.org. Now we are going to continue talking about the importance of the Native vote, and we'd like to welcome Polly Dennett-Claw to the show. Polly has written extensively about obstacles facing Native American voters. Polly Dennett-Claw is an award-winning reporter based in Gallup, New Mexico. She has worked for the Navajo Times and the Texas Observer. Her radio pieces have aired on a number of stations, including Texas Public Radio and NPR's Latino USA. And Polly is a board member of the Native American Journalists Association. Hi, Polly. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I also want to mention you've got a number of articles up, Felony Disenfranchisement of Indigenous Voters. Many Indigenous Democrats support a ceasefire in Gaza. And then another important one that we'll ask you about later in the show, Vice President Kamala Harris's mixed record on Indigenous issues. So we were just talking about what happened under the Trump administration, just opening up so many Indigenous lands to more drilling. Project 2025 would continue that. In the reporting that you have done, what are you hearing from Native people about what is at stake in the upcoming election?
So one of the things that I do want to note is that Indigenous nations are not a monolith, and there are a lot of Indigenous nations and Indigenous leaders who do support oil and gas. And so when we look at places like the Willow Project in Alaska, there were a lot of local Indigenous folks who do live in the North Slope, whose the majority of folks in those communities supported the Willow Project and welcomed that into their communities and their lands. And there are also a lot of Navajo people, particularly around Chaco Canyon, around the 10-mile buffer, who did not want the buffer in place because it impacted, they thought that it impacted their leasing rights. And so just to make that clear as well, but there are a number of issues that Indigenous people are that are important to Native voters, but it just varies based on community to community.
Yeah, it's so right. I remember going to Standing Rock and heard the same thing from people who talked about how their tribe cut deals with the oil and gas industry. So as you say, it's not a monolith. Can you talk about, I mean, of course, and there are many reasons for that. People need jobs at the end of the day. People need to feed their families. But can you talk more about that and the debate that you're hearing in Indian country about oil and gas drilling? Because we saw A lot happened under Trump. We see it happening under Obama. A lot of natives are very, Biden, and we did under Obama, but a lot of natives are very critical of the Biden administration because of their oil and gas drilling policies. So this, I mean, as you say, this is definitely not a black and white issue.
Yes. So when it comes to oil and gas, there are a lot of tribal governments that and tribal nations that really do rely on money from oil and gas leasing to fund their government, to fund programming within their communities. And so that is why they continue to support sort of like energy development on their lands. And so another example of that is the Navajo Nation, despite, you know, the Navajo Nation moving away from energy development, it continues to be part of the conversation. And it's also not just like energy development, but for the Navajo Nation, they're looking to do mining of gravel to help to really cut costs when it comes to having roads on the Navajo Nation. So only, I think it's only 20% of the roads on Navajo Nation, which goes across three states. It's the largest tribal nation land-wise in the country. And they are trying to figure out how to cut costs of paving roads. The estimate that I last heard was that it's $1 million per mile of road. And 80% of the Navajo Nation's roads are not paved. And so one of the
80%?
80%.
Wow.
Yeah. And so one of those cost-cutting measures was, you know, mining for gravel.
Wow. That's just a devastating statistic. According to the Navajo Water Project, on the Navajo Nation, 30% of families live without running water. I just think it's so important to talk about these things, Polly, because I don't know if a lot of people realize that just on the Navajo Nation, 30% of families do not have running water in the year 2024.
And this is also an issue that just does impact large land-based tribes. And so tribal nations with a lot of sovereign lands have similar issues of not having enough infrastructure for the number of people who live on their lands.
Mm. And we should say that while there's a debate and while there are tribes that do cut deals with various industries, there's also major protests against this. NPR just had a piece a couple of months ago about how indigenous leaders and activists are protesting uranium shipments across the Navajo Nation. And then there are just also protests on a regular basis about various extraction happening on indigenous lands.
Yes. So another one that I would love for folks to know about is in North Carolina, where there is also a development that runs through ancestral lands of indigenous nations in North Carolina. And it's a pipeline, a oil and gas pipeline that runs through their ancestral lands. And a lot of the tribal nations in North Carolina are not federally recognized. And so that they're state recognized tribes, but they don't have the same sort of ability to take this to federal court in the same way that federally recognized tribes are able to. And so that again is another issue. And you have indigenous people in North Carolina who have been protesting that pipeline for decades.
Let's talk a bit about more about what is at stake in this election. We know, you know, Donald Trump, J.D. Vance say if they're elected, the first thing they're going to do is drill, baby, drill. This is obviously their words. So we're just going to see more mining, more drilling, more deregulation on indigenous lands. Project 2025 also calls for this and a major reshaping of the Department of the Interior. Is there anything else you'd like to add about what's at stake in this election if Donald Trump wins the election?
I think that when it comes to, you know, what happened in the previous Trump administration, and from what I have heard from folks, is that there was a lot of neglect when it came to what was needed in for tribal nations and for tribal leaders. And that neglect really impacted tribal nations. And so that's one of the things that folks have been worried about and have been talking about, is that Donald Trump in his last administration didn't hold the Tribal Nations Summit, which was created under former President Barack Obama. And, you know, his administration did that nearly every year of his administration. And then under the Trump administration, that did not happen. And the Tribal Nations Summit is where tribal leaders come from all over the country. You know, over 500 tribes, tribal leaders are invited, and they're able to come and talk to the president, the vice president. They're able to talk to the cabinet about some of the issues that are important to these nations. And again, Indian country is so diverse, Native nations are so diverse, that having that opportunity is really important. And it's really important to tribal leaders as well. And so that didn't happen. But under the Biden administration, it was revived and continued. And so that is one of the things, too, that is very concerning.
And then with Kamala Harris, you have an important piece about her record on indigenous issues. And you write that Kamala Harris spent 6 years as a state attorney general fighting against tribal nations, 4 years in Congress, where she sponsored a number of progressive Native American legislation, and one term with the Biden administration, which has been one of the strongest, if not the strongest, presidential allies to indigenous nations in history. So there's a lot to unpack there. What are you hearing from, again, not a monolith, but what are you hearing from Native people about Kamala Harris's record and what they expect her to do if she wins the presidential election in Indian country?
So one of the things that is definitely, there are a lot of Native voters who will support Kamala Harris and Tim Walz in this election, and in the hopes that they will care about the issues that are important to them. And one of those major issues is what's happening in Palestine. And that continues to be one of the issues that is brought up continuously in the rhetoric that's going on online, is, you know, her stance on that issue and the Biden administration's stance on that issue. And a lot of Native people support a ceasefire, as I have written before, and a lot of tribal leaders support a ceasefire. And, you know, there has been conversations about a shared history of colonization that Native people sort of talk about when they're talking about Palestine and the war that's happening there. And so that is what's being brought up, but also just the record of President Biden and how positive the relationship has been between the Biden administration and tribal nations, even though his administration did, you know, work out a deal for the Willow Project, which was very controversial, even with within tribal nations and within Indigenous people who care very deeply about the environment. That was very disappointing for a lot of people, but at the same time, it was very much celebrated among Alaska Native leaders, Indigenous leaders in Alaska who live in the North Slope and who rely on the money that's generated from that to fund infrastructure and schools and you know, local municipalities in those areas. And so that is part of the conversation as well. And then the other thing too is the mining issues for green energy and lithium. So again, you know, we're having lithium mining on sacred sites for Indigenous people and Indigenous nations. And that continues to be an issue. And then again, you know, Biden appointed the first ever Native American Secretary of the Interior, which, you know, was very much celebrated amongst a lot of Native folks and Native communities. And, you know, it has been super, from folks, they have said that it's been super beneficial to have a Native person in that position.
We are speaking today about the Native American vote and what is important to Native Americans, what's at stake in the upcoming election. Polly Dennett-Claw is an award-winning reporter based in Gallup, New Mexico. She's a political correspondent for Indian Country Today and has worked for the Navajo Times and the Texas Observer. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Diane in Alameda, who's been waiting patiently. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, thank you so much for this program on Native people and the election. And I know you've been focusing on the presidency. And I stepped out of the room, and I don't know if anyone has mentioned that Jonathan Nez is running for District 2 Congress from Arizona. He's a past president of Navajo Nation. He is endorsed by Rudy Gallegos, and he is an excellent person. I know him personally, and I just wanted to mention that and see if any of your guests have any comment on that. He's running a good campaign. He was not expected to even get as far as he did, and he's really catching up with Eli Crane, who is the incumbent. So I just wanted to mention that. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. We have not mentioned this. Polly, have you been reporting on Jonathan Nez?
Yes. So I actually, after former president, Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez, after he did not win his presidential election in 2022, a couple weeks after that, I asked if he would consider running for Congress. And at that time, he said that that was not something that was at the forefront. He was more concerned about finishing out his administration. But he did say at that time that that would, you know, all things are on the table. And a year later, almost exactly, he announced that he was running for Congress. And one of the things to note about Arizona's second congressional district is that it has been gerrymandered to sort of dilute the Native vote in that district. It was pretty much a Democratic district, and then it got pulled 7 points to the right. Wow. And so now it's very much a Republican district, and they put in a lot of voters from southern Arizona from southern Arizona who are more conservative voters. And Eli Crane, a first-time candidate, had no name recognition, you know, won an election by 7 points against an incumbent with a well-known name and relationship with Native voters in that area. And so it was very concerning when that incumbent did lose to basically somebody who had no name recognition and was a first-time candidate. And according to, reporting, doesn't even live in the district.
Hmm.
And yeah.
Are you familiar, just quickly, Polly, about what happened with the redistricting of that congressional district? Do you know how that happened?
Yes. So Arizona's legislature is a Republican. So it is the majority in, I believe, the House and the Senate. I'm going to need fact checking on this. But the last that I heard was that they were both held by the Republican Party. And so that during the redistricting process, that's sort of how that happened back in 2020. I should say at the time of redistricting in 2020 to 2022, it was a Republican-held House and Senate. for Arizona state legislator. And so as they were going through that process of redistricting, they diluted the Native vote in Arizona District 2 and included more conservative voters in Southern Arizona into that district. And they're still sort of battling over redistricting that as we speak.
This is just so ugly. I just looked it up. Republicans do control the House and the Senate in Arizona. And there was a piece in The Guardian, May 2022. Democrats supported by indigenous voters won every election for the past 10 years in a district drawn to empower Native American voters. But new redistricting commissioners did not have to comply with the Justice Department's pre-clearance requirements after the landmark Voting Rights Act provision was dismantled by the conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court. I mean, again, this is why the Voting Rights Act is so important, but unfortunately, that section was shot down by the conservatives on the Supreme Court, and this is where we are now. And I just wanted to mention, media is reporting that this race with Jonathan Nez is really close. And if he wins in Arizona, he could be the first Native American in Congress from Arizona. So that's definitely an important race to watch. I also wanted to ask you, Polly, before we let you go, about your latest piece for Indian Country Today, Felony Disenfranchisement of Indigenous Voters. There is no national data on the impact of felony disenfranchisement on Indigenous people, despite being overly represented in the criminal justice system. So tell us more about what you found.
Yes, so this is an issue that was really important for me to cover because of, you know, there are jurisdictional issues within tribal nations and within tribal lands specifically. And on sovereign lands, more often than not, if there is a crime committed, it is often charged as a felony. And so there is, you know, data that Indigenous people are more often than not charged with felonies, and instead of sort of misdemeanors, if it were handled in tribal courts or if it were handled, say, for example, a municipality, and instead they are given felony convictions. And so that's just because who takes over jurisdiction? It's the federal government. And from the information that I've been gathered is that the federal government is just used to charging for felonies. And so that's a clear issue within Indian Country, within Indigenous nations. And that, again, goes to impacting the Native vote. And it's, I know that you all had Jacqueline De Leon on. She's a wonderful, amazing wealth of information. And she also talked about this, or her organization, the Native American Rights Fund, talked about this in their barriers to voting study that they did. And they noted felony disenfranchisement as one of the issues that Native voters face. And there's a lot of sort of, there's no information on the fact that there are many, many people who have been convicted of felonies who are able to vote. And that information is not getting out to local governments who are denying people based on quote unquote felony convictions and are denying them their right to vote despite it being the law that they're able to. And it's just because this information is not being dispersed to the people that it needs to.
Can you give us an example of where this is happening, where it is legal for people to vote, but they just don't have the information?
Yes. So we see this in New Mexico. And I talked with folks who work on this issue at the ground level, and they have noted, you know, this just happened in the last legislative session. They were able to expand the Voting Rights Act to include, to allow for folks who are out of prison, who are on parole, who are or probation, and allowing them to be able to vote where previously they were not allowed to until they finish probation or their probationary periods. And so now they're able to, but what they're seeing on the grounds is that there are a lot of local sort of county folks who have not heard this information, who have not been dispersed this information, and are continuing to deny, you know, some of the 17,000 folks who are not eligible to vote. You know, they're denying them even the ability to register to vote.
You have a very important line in your piece. The United States is the only modern democracy in the world that continues to strip its citizens of voting rights because of past criminal convictions.
Yes. So that information came from the Brennan Center for Justice, I believe, is the name of it. And they did a wonderful study on all of this and noted that in their study that the United States is the only modern democracy who continues to do that. And we don't see this in other parts of the world.
Wow. Yeah, that's another incredible fact about this country that needs more attention. Jacqueline told you it has definitely been buried for a long time. A lot of people don't think about Native people when they think about police brutality or all of the abuses of the system that occur at the state and federal level. We have to continue to investigate and shine a light on this injustice so that we can get change. Final thoughts? Is there anything else in this reporting that deserves more attention that just doesn't get the attention you think that it should?
Yeah, so I just think that it's really important for folks who have gone through the criminal justice system to, one, be able to vote because they have a unique and different perspective in that they've gone through the criminal justice system. And as we see, you know, it's been very well reported that Indigenous people, you know, they face racism, they face a lot of conditions within prisons and jails that unless they're there to talk about it and speak about it, folks, you know, in the community don't know that this is happening. And so having people who have gone through the criminal justice system be able to talk about and advocate and vote for what they think is important and the change that they would like to see within our communities, because oftentimes those who go through the criminal justice system are the most vulnerable in the community, you know, facing poverty and a number of other issues. And so having that perspective is very needed within a democracy.
Polly Dennett-Claw is an award-winning reporter in Gallup, Mexico. She's a political correspondent for Indian Country Today. Thank you so much for your reporting, Polly, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.